Hey, it's your boy JC.
And Dr. Capel.
And welcome to the Dream to Next podcast. And this is episode... Do you know what episode it is?
70?
No.
Uh-oh.
80!
Eight? Wow.
80 episodes we've done.
That's incredible.
And we are into, I think, around book 14 of our attempt... Our execution of reading 52 books in 52 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is like week 14.
I like implementation better than execution.
Our implementation, whatever. It's not a dream. It's not a desire. It's something we are doing. We're executing.
Action steps.
Yep. Why? To learn. To learn new things.
And share with you.
And to share, yeah. Mm-hmm. And to practice elocution and practice speaking. And I noticed that in our last episode, I watched that video a lot, where you presented about Stan Lee. And how I wasn't the main person talking, and so I had to sit there and be actively listening to you, and I came off as a complete idiot because I
You just, did not!
Because you're talking so fast, and you're thinking so fast, and you're so excited about Stan Lee and She-Hulk.
Which means I need to slow down a little bit, yeah?
Well, I love it. I loved it that you were so animated. Mm-hmm. It was engaging, and I was like, okay. Even as I'm watching, mm-hmm. You're talking so fast, I'm like... Like, you pull me in, and I'm like trying to follow you.
Yeah.
But I noticed that while I'm sitting there trying to be actively listening, I wasn't following you all the way. And it took me a long time with certain things to like catch up with what you were talking about.
Okay.
I'm like, damn, she's like a quantum computer. I'm like a 386, you know? I'm just like really slow in processing what you're putting out. So I need to work on that a little bit. But so anyway, that aside, this week... We are reviewing, there it is, we are reviewing the Philip K. Dick book called The Man in the High Castle, and this book is an Amazon series. It's a really intriguing, fun show to watch on Amazon, and so I thought, I got this book as a gift from one of my kids. I think it was Claire, thank you Claire, and she's a big reader, so I think she gave me all these science fiction books. But it's really interesting to now read the book and kind of compare it with the show. And I was really intrigued by how it was so difficult to line the two up. And so we're going to talk about five key takeaways. My first takeaway from this book is that it was a lot more abstract and kind of hard to get your head around what the story was all about relative to the show on Amazon.
So it's kind of two different beasts.
It is in a way, but it's the same general story.
Yeah.
Same general story being that, you know, we're in a different, the story takes place in an alternate post-World War II universe where Nazi Germany and Japan win the wars and they split America in two, and the Japanese get the West Coast and the Nazi Germany gets the East Coast. So that story is pretty much the same.
Mm.
A lot of the characters are pretty much the same. But the show puts a much finer point on the storyline and makes it more engaging than the book does.
So it's easier to understand and,
It's kind of easier to understand, And I was almost done with the book and I was still waiting for the punchline. Like, what's going to happen?
Oh, gosh.
So you almost don't find out what the punchline is until the very end of this book. But it was a good read, and you can tell by reading the book how much of a genius Philip K. Dick is. He's really, 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 he was a really, really, really smart guy. The show is just much more engaging. It's more fun to watch the show than it was to kind of read the story. My second key takeaway from the book was that books actually play a central role in the story.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And... So one of the books that's key, plays a key aspect or a key role in this book is a book called The Grasshopper Lies Low.
That was in the movie too, but I think it was the film.
It was the film.
Yeah.
It was the film, but in this book, it's another book.
Okay.
And so that book is about a suggestive alternate reality where America actually wins the war. Or not, the Allies win the war, excuse me, and the UK or Great Britain is actually the predominant power at the end of the war. And so if you think about it, it's kind of a recursive, strange loop.
Yeah.
Like we're, you know, our current reality is, you know, the Axis allies won the war and, you know, Nazis and the Japanese lost.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are as somebody in Western America reading a book about the reality being Nazi Germany and the Japanese winning the war, which is a book about a book where somebody else actually won the war.
That's so crazy.
And so it's this weird, like, inception thing when you think about it.
Yeah.
It's just like this strange loop that Dr. Hofstadter talks about and Gerda Lauscher-Bach. And I kept thinking about that, you know. So he incorporates this strange loop in his book. And I'm pretty sure he does it consciously. And when you think about that, it's like, man, he was really into some strange stuff. He was really a smart guy, Dick, the author, Philip K. Dick. So that was interesting to contemplate, kind of the Russian doll idea of different, you know, stories inside of a story, inside of a story, inside of a reality, and, you know.
That's just so cool.
Another key book that played a central role in the book, in this book, was the book called The I Ching. It's not just I Ching.
I used to have that. I need to see if I still do or not. Because you were talking about it yesterday, and I'm like, oh, I know that, but I don't remember like all the things around it. But I used to have it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because
I bought it. Because I bought it with another couple of books that I had, like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is amazing.
That's Tibetan.
What I said.
Oh,
yeah.
See, I don't hear it. You talk so fast.
I said my fingers in front of my face.
Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah, so that's, I bought it at the same time as that in Nebraska. And so I'm trying to remember, but I think we might still have it. I'm not sure.
So the I Ching Book of Change.
Which is totally relevant to you guys, by the way. That I have it or not. That exists.
Irrelevant. Yes, it's totally irrelevant. But yeah, so the I Ching Book of Change, I thought it was just a fictional book referenced in the book because they reference that for, the characters in the story reference the I Ching Book of Change for information about their near future, the long-term future. It's like, they call it the oracle. They do something with something. I didn't quite understand how they consult it, but somehow it references chapters in the book and they read it and then it's supposed to be revelatory about what their near-term future has to hold for them.
Mm-hmm.
And is that like the real book? So it is a real Chinese book?
Mm-hmm. Chinese divination.
So the I Ching is a Chinese, what do you call it? Divination book, yes. I Ching is the Chinese divination book. Mm-hmm. And so those two books kind of played very central roles throughout the story, which is also interesting. You got a divination book from China and a book written by a Westerner that I won't go into and reveal the story, but it's also kind of a revelatory book as well. And so
that's,
I thought
the
that was
book?
The Grasshopper book. Is, yeah, so that was really interesting to kind of ponder. The third key takeaway, I actually read about after I read the book, reading about Philip K. Dick and how he came about writing the story, The Man in the High Castle. He was on his third wife, Philip K. Dick. He was married to 5 different women.
Good grief!
In his lifetime. He died at like 52 or 54.
Because he was married to 5 different women!
Yes. I guess that'll do it to him. Do it to him, bro, man. he was on his third wife. Her name was Anne, and she was making jewelry at the time.
Hmm.
So it sounded like they weren't very wealthy, and that they were just like most Americans trying to figure their stuff out. They were in California, and she was starting up a business making jewelry, and he would help polish the silver jewelry for her.
Oh, wow, okay.
And apparently they butted heads like crazy and got into physical altercations and everything. And so he kind of like, all right, he got out of her space and let her do her thing. And he rented a little cabin kind of up the road from and used that cabin to live in to start writing a book.
Oh, cool.
And he was an author at the time, but he wasn't quite sure what to write about. But somehow this word popped into his head Tagomi. And he wrote it down on a slip of paper, and that's the word, that's the name that he started with to write this whole book.
Wow.
And Mr. Tagomi, who's a Japanese character, Nobusuke Tagomi, was a central Japanese character in the whole story, and he's the one who kind of, like, you know, saves the world at this time in the story.
That's wild.
And it took him... So I was really impressed by the author's knowledge of German and Japanese culture, especially at the time, that history, you know,
and
with the Nazi...
And when was it written again?
So this book came out in 1962.
Okay.
He finished it in November of 1961. And he had a really deep knowledge of Nazi Germany and German culture, as well as Japanese culture at the time. And I was kind of blown away by the details that he presents in the book. Come to find out, reading after I finished the book, that it took him 7 years of researching that.
Oh.
So he did a lot of research into that culture.
Did he travel at all, I wonder?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if he traveled a lot.
Interesting. Okay.
But he did read German, and I know that he read German, and he immersed himself into both the Japanese and the German Nazi cultures.
Wild.
He read a lot of diaries from Nazi soldiers and stuff like that.
And pulled out those details.
And he pulled in a lot of those details in the story. Yeah. And so I was like, man, this guy's a freaking genius to know about all this stuff and to pull it in. But not only the cultures, but also just the whole idea of kind of metaphysics and all the stuff that, you know, like, you know, questioning reality and creating alternate realities and all that stuff is almost like weird, like the knowledge that he pulls in, or the ideas that he pulls into.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just really impressed by that, the depth of weirdness, kind of, which it's not saying it correctly, but the knowledge of what could be, you know, pulled into the book.
Yeah.
The thing I also read about was how poorly received the book. So he had his wife Anne read the book, and she's like, this is not a very good book. You're probably only going to make like $750 from this. So she was like point blank blunt with him.
Wow.
And I don't think she was far off. I don't think it's a great book.
Yeah.
I think it's the storyline is a little weak, I gotta say. Like, the storyline is not weak. The idea is really great, and the proof of that is what Amazon was able to do with that, I think. So it's like an abstract idea that was kind of half-baked.
Yeah.
Really great idea. A lot of good detail on Nazi culture and Japanese culture, but the story was kind of half-baked, and then I think Amazon put a finer point on the whole thing.
Yeah, so it's really understandable.
And really intriguing.
Yeah.
So I think he was almost there. It's just, I don't know. But it was easily published.
Mm-hmm.
He got a publisher very, very quickly. They paid him something like $1,500 for it. So he doubled what his wife said he would get. and then, but when he had it translated in Japanese, the Japanese feedback was, this is not our culture. Like, you did a really poor job representing us.
Huh.
And that's not... You know, I don't know what you were talking about. It's a very poorly written book. And then the German translation, he reads German, so he did a very detailed review of it.
Yeah.
And it was not done very well in the German language either. So he was really kind of depressed about the whole thing.
Sure.
But it's still a work of genius in a lot of ways. So it's kind of weird in that regard. Okay, so Mr. Tagomi... was central figure, word, name in the creation of the whole story, which I don't see how that happened, but he pulled it off. Number four, there, in relates to number three, there's a weird mix of Japanese and Chinese culture in the whole thing. And so the Japanese review of the book pointed that out.
Yeah.
Like, that's not Japanese culture. We would never do something like that.
Yeah.
You know, we would never consult the I Ching, for example.
Yeah, yeah. Very different.
And, but so why did he include that? It's weird.
Yeah.
Like, why would he pull those two and kind of meld them into one thing? It was an odd thing, and I definitely picked up on it as well. Like, why is he pulling in like Chinese and Japanese culture in the same? But if you go on the West Coast, you see that the combination of those two influences.
Mm-hmm.
So I could kind of get that. He lived in the West Coast, maybe. I don't know. Also, there was an interesting conversation between a Japanese high-ranking official, Mr. Tagomi, and a Childen, Mr. Childen, who was the guy who ran that shop. Whatever that trinket shop or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're looking at different types of artifacts, and they're considering them. And the Japanese official is contemplating how he feels about a certain object, mm-hmm. and he starts mentioning wabi, which is wabi sabi is a Japanese phrase for considering things that are simple and imperfect but beautiful. So wabi sabi is kind of a simple but imperfect beautiful thing.
Like everything I make with blacksmithing. It's wabi-sabi. Very imperfect.
It's wabi-sabi. That's a very good way. It's simple. It's imperfect. It's beautiful. Yes. It's perfect. Wabi-sabi. But rather than go further with calling it wabi-sabi, mm-hmm. the phrase woo comes up, and the Japanese official says, oh, this object has a great woo mm-hmm. with it. And I didn't know what woo meant, but woo is a Chinese term, and it's an expression of something that's unique and very beautiful. But from a Chinese culture perspective. So again, he's melding these two, and he's having the Japanese official use the term woo, I thought that was kind of strange. I didn't kind of get all that, but.
And in StrengthsFinder, it's winning others over, so that's all fascinating.
Woo?
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, what's your woo?
Yeah. Me?
What's your woo?
I think in my 36 StrengthsFinder, I'm about a 15 in woo.
There's a number associated with woo power?
Well, depending on like what your strength, so there's 34 strengths, and so when you take the assessment, it's like, what's your top strength versus your less? So positivity is my top strength, but I think woo is like in the middle of the board for me.
Interesting.
Yeah. Positivity, man.
Yeah. Woo and wabi-sabi. Those are two interesting, cool terms.
I want to embrace that more.
And for the fifth key takeaway from this episode, I thought it was interesting that there are rockets in this world, in the story, that take people from the East Coast over to the West Coast and vice versa.
That's
in a matter of minutes or hours. And the rocket technology, the rocket companies are all owned by the Nazis.
Of course.
And the Germans, since they're the ones who kind of created the rockets in World War II with Wernher von Braun and all those people, the scientists. And the rocket company is called Lufthansa.
Wait a second.
Yeah. And the rockets land vertically, so you're strapped in your chair. At least this is how I envisioned it from the words that I gathered from the story. You're strapped in your chair, and the rocket starts to descend to the landing pad, and then the stewardess comes on and says, Meine Damen und Herren, Achtung bitte. So it starts giving you landing and safety instructions in German first, and then they do Japanese, and then English is the third
language that they do.
So that was really intriguing.
I just had flashbacks to flying to Germany.
On Lufthansa. Or Swiss Air, one of the two. And, of course, the Nazis have a Mars colony as well, because they're starting to colonize the solar system using their rocket technology, and so that was a really weird thing to think about in this alternate universe that the story kind of portrays.
Wow.
So those are my five key takeaways from this episode. Do you have anything else you want to add on there?
No, it's a really fascinating book, and I love that he talked about the differences between the movie and the book, because oftentimes you really love one or the other more, and so I think it's interesting that the movie was able to actually bring the story to life in a very intentional way that reading the book is probably not something I would want to do based on what you just described, because I like a little bit more solidified story, but I love the movie, so I like how they were able to do that and really bring it to a broader audience.
I don't want to downplay the book. The book brings in a lot of different angles that you don't get from the show, but the show is definitely...
factors and things.
Right. Yeah. But the show is definitely much more fun to watch than the book was to read, I guess. So anyways, thanks for listening to this episode. We will catch you next book. Dream 10X out. If you are interested in buying any of the used books that we have reviewed so far, like this Joe Camel book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, just point your web browser at dream10x.com/store and pick any of the books that we've reviewed so far, name your price, we will put our signatures in the book and send it off to you right away. And I know you're thinking, who cares about your signatures? Well, hey, you gotta think ahead, because one day those signatures are gonna be worth something. Because I'm your boy JC with the Dream 10X podcast.